Hello, I'm Richard Dagenais. This is number 0249, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of The Stuff File Program, number 0249. And coming up on this edition of The Stuff File Program, you'll meet Woodrow Landfair, who is the author of Land of the Free. He spent 8 years traveling through 48 states on a used motorcycle. You have to be both outgoing and a loner to pull off such a trip.
You almost have to be somebody who's extremely comfortable being alone and likes having his own company, yet somebody who's completely comfortable taking over a room and talking to everybody at once, or just sort of glad-handing one at a time in order to meet people to keep this thing alive. But be able to do it in a natural way where you don't look like a weirdo, you know, doing things like that, I guess.
Filmmaker David Mech has a documentary called Risky Business, a look inside America's adult film industry.
Most of the documentaries out there on porn are more about the business of porn. There wasn't a lot about the performers. You know, where do they come from? How do they get into business? What are their experiences in the business? And then after they get out of the business, you know, how do they handle careers, relationships, the social stigma that comes along with it? So we talk about a lot of, like, you know, potential regulation that could come, both in the health and safety side, as well as in the employment discrimination that a lot of people face when they get out of the business.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter goes to the baseball diamond with Up, Up, and Away. A look at the 35-year bittersweet saga of the Montreal Expos. So watch for the return of Knows I More later on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0249, was Richard Dagenais, anchor at Global Montreal's Morning News. Thank you very much, Richard, for doing the opening for this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Finding a job might be difficult these days, but this might be a tad ridiculous. A man stole a New York City bread truck and began delivering baked goods to random businesses. David Bastar hopped into the Grimaldi's Home of Bread truck on Manhattan's Upper East Side while the real driver was making a delivery at a pizzeria. Reportedly, wearing only his underwear, Bastar then allegedly began dropping off baguettes, whole wheat rolls, and sourdough bread, but not to the bakery's customers. Joe Grimaldi, the owner of the bakery, said, "The bread was left somewhere. Where, I don't know. He dropped off a lot of bread." Grimaldi said about $5,000 in bread was taken. The bakery later was able to accommodate all of its customers. "It's a bizarre incident, but nothing happened to the truck. No one was hurt. There was no damage. I got my truck back," said Grimaldi. Bastar was arrested later at LaGuardia Airport, where police say he wound up after tailgating a driver for several miles. The driver became concerned about being followed and called police. Police determined that the truck had been stolen that morning. Bastar was taken to a hospital for a checkup from the neck up and was charged with criminal possession of stolen goods and driving without a license. Ironically, Grimaldi said a shuttle bus driver who witnessed the arrest called a bakery and said, "If you need a driver, I'll work for you." Wow. It seems that just about everybody wants to drive a bread truck. Do they know the difference between rolling in dough and simply rolling dough? I don't know. Anyway, moving right along, Brian Veach was flying a plane towing a large ad banner when it started to go down. He ditched the banner and crashed into a house in North Glen, Colorado. Veach jumped out of his plane into the second story of the house and called 911. He escaped unharmed, but the plane was a total loss, and the resulting fire caused significant damage to the house. Veach later realized he had previously owned the house he crashed into. He was pulling the ad for Dragonfly banners. The banner touted insurance. Yeah. Well, let's see how fast the insurance company is going to settle this bizarre claim. Yes. A Tennessee man was arrested after he walked into a bar and tried to have sex with an ATM machine. Oh, let me repeat that sentence again. a Tennessee man was arrested after he walked into a bar and tried to have sex with an ATM machine. 49-year-old Lonnie Hutton was apprehended at the Borough Bar and Grill in Murfreesboro. Now, according to police, an officer was dispatched to the bar where a witness said that Hutton walked to an ATM and pulled down his pants and underwear, exposing his genitals, and then attempted to have sexual intercourse with the ATM. After his encounter with the ATM, Hutton began to walk around the bar nude, thrusting his hips in the air. Hutton was subsequently escorted from the bar and told to sit on a wooden picnic table. But once outside the bar, Hutton allegedly again exposed himself and engaged in sexual intercourse with the wooden picnic table. To the surprise of no one, police reported that Hutton smelled of booze, had bloodshot eyes, and slurred speech. Wow. Sex with an ATM machine. I guess he doesn't know those machines are only used for withdrawals, not deposits. Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Florida police officers who were attempting to catch a suspected car thief got a little help when an alligator decided to cross the road. Port St. Lucie police were on the lookout for a man they suspected had taken at least five cars from parking lots at Walmart, Sam's Club, and Publix. Officers eventually spotted Calvin Rodriguez in a Honda Civic and tried to stop him. Unfortunately, the car began driving at a high speed, and they lost sight of it. That's when the alligator stepped in. Police were able to catch up to Rodriguez when he hit the alligator and was stopped. According to the police report, the Honda was later discovered to have crashed into an alligator, causing it to crash into a median. Rodriguez was charged with five counts of grand theft auto, but is not facing animal cruelty charges for hitting the alligator. It's pretty unimaginable that police officers would be at that point in time looking for these suspects, and that an alligator unfortunately just happens to cross the road and assist us in catching these criminals, according to Detective Keith Boham. Well, the cops got their man, and I'm sure someone else is going to get a lovely pair of shoes and a matching handbag. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Woodrow Lanfair spent the better part of a decade on the road. He pawned everything he owned and got a secondhand motorcycle to research and write what would become the book Land of the Free. It's a journey that took him through 48 states in 8 years. Woodrow is on the line with us right now from Virginia. Hi, Woodrow.
Hi, Peter. So good to hear from you.
Nice to hear from you, too.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm excited.
Nice to have you, too. Now, what made you decide way back when to say, I'm ditching everything, I'm hitting the open road?
I'd say it's about childhood dreams to some extent, which I think I'm sure you've had and I've had. We all have things we always want to do in our lives. And like most people, I'd say I had a list. And for a long time, I don't know if I really moved forward that list, and I got lucky with the first thing on it, and I figured, well, why not take a chance at the next thing I got down the line? And that happened to be to write a novel about searching America, and I'd outlined it, and I thought the only way I'm going to actually write it and really finish it and know what the story is like if I go out there and at least try to live it.
Okay, so
give it my best shot.
So you planned this out. This is one of your dreams, one of your goals. I'm sure you figured out what you were going to do and how you're going to do it as you went along. What was the biggest surprise that you had along the way that sort of taught you that, well, gee, this isn't going exactly as I planned?
the biggest surprise in the overall is probably the real enemy, the biggest thing stopping me was myself. Overall, you just run into situations where you realize the biggest hurdle you have is you have a fear of speaking to somebody, or you have a fear of telling somebody the story that you know they need to hear in order to give you a job, or the story that they need to hear in order to help you out. And you might know it's there, you might see it, and I don't mean make up a story that's completely false, but I mean to emotionally connect with somebody and be present. And to have that relationship with people, because, you know, once you make those connections, it's easy to find a job and a place to sleep and friends, and you can do that anywhere. So it's always the hardest part for me was just really getting to a place where I was so honestly comfortable with myself to speak to other people and have good relationships.
What was it you were leaving behind before you started your journey?
well, I had a real nice life. generally, but I had read, you know, the books of Bob Dylan Chronicles and the autobiography of Woody Guthrie, stories about people who'd left their home to create something else out of their life, entirely different from what they had started in a way. And I wanted to do that. So I'd grown up playing baseball my whole life and being an athlete. And one of the biggest goals of my life was to somehow win a championship or to win a world title or to win an Olympic gold medal. And then after that, I thought it would be a Navy SEAL. So I was in college as an ROTC student on a full scholarship from the Navy, hoping to become a Navy SEAL in a couple years and playing college baseball, which couldn't be much further than where I was just about two years ago, working in theater as a stagehand in New York, which I guess is what happens if you leave on a motorcycle and try and invent a new life for yourself.
So 48 states, 8 years, in that time period, what was the situation or locale that impressed you the most? I mean, you know, it's a very large country you have there.
Well, that's right, you know, and, well, Canada's not too small itself up there. So, but yeah, it's beautiful. And I'd say what surprised me the most, you know, for me, a lot of where I needed to go depended on where I needed to get work. And that became an interesting thing to look at just sociologically, look at the nation sociologically and geographically as where you can get easier jobs than others. But really, just as far as surprises go, that was the question, right? I think I went off on that, huh?
Yep. So what was the biggest surprise?
You know, other than the way I was treated, I would say that was a big surprise, just the way I'm treated by people in general, you know, and I can be good and bad. But some places I would feel treated extremely well. Other places you'd become really aware of race or other things. You say, you know, these people treat me very well. I wonder how it would be if I was, you know, if I was the only black person in this room suddenly, or if I was, you know, of another ethnicity or Hispanic and on the same trip and I was suddenly in Idaho in a room with 100 people who'd really never spent much time with a Hispanic person before. I don't know if it would have went over that well, to be honest with you. So that was interesting to see that firsthand in little pockets of the country.
What are the kind of jobs that you did along the way? And I'm assuming that you've done jobs on this trip that you've never done before.
That was the idea, just to get in with working level manual labor jobs. So I started out sleeping outside, just because I didn't have a better plan, and I had $3,000 in cash, so I wanted to make it last. So I started out that way, and I started out going up and just looking for help wanted signs. So that led me to working in places like gas stations and doing fun things like clerking and unclogging toilets. I got a lot of jobs bouncing or doing like bartender bar work, you know, as a bar back. That's an easy job to get frequently, as well as anything sort of cleaning or just any job you can find people who need their basements cleaned, things like that. A lot of times you can find them on the internet. But yeah, I like to think I've worked almost every job under the sun as far as manual labor goes.
And in those 8 years and in 48 states, what's the biggest thing you learned about yourself?
Wow, you hit me with the hard questions now, huh? The big ones. About myself, I guess for a while I felt like, you know, I was on a mission personally. I don't think I could really share that, or that would be something other people identify with, that you'd have a mission to write a novel about a guy who's inventing a new life for himself while going through the 48 states, and you feel like you have to go out and live parts of it firsthand. I don't know if that's a mission for other people. But what I realized about myself, I'd say, is that what I thought were forces opposing myself from other people or from sort of the outside world turned out really to be just more issues of my own confidence, where I had to get over learning how to become a bigger person or adapt to challenges. And previously, I guess, I had seen it as something else, like that there would be some sort of insurmountable challenges in life, or that there would be, and I would be pushed in certain directions. And, you know, moving along with this project and being able to, you know, I was sleeping on the streets a couple of years ago, and every day, you know. And so to be moved along now in life to where I am now 8 years later with the book about to come out in June and things going very nicely, it's nice to know that you can push yourself in any direction you want.
I get the impression, most of the times, I get a feeling that there are basically two kinds of people, outgoing, gregarious people or those who are loners. And I somehow get the feeling that to do what you did, you kind of have to be a little bit of both.
Wow. Well, that's I think that's a very astute observation. Not to look in too much on myself, but I would say that's exactly accurate. You almost have to be somebody who's extremely comfortable being alone and likes having his own company, yet somebody who's completely comfortable taking over a room and talking to everybody at once, or just sort of glad handing one at a time to in order to meet people to keep this thing alive. But be able to do it in a natural way where you don't look like a weirdo, you know, doing things like that, I guess.
So now that your book is coming out in June, again, the book is called Land of the Free, what's next for you?
You know, that's a question I've been getting a lot. And, you know, this is a dream come true just to be here. So first of all, I'm excited to be here and excited to do an interview like this. And very excited that the book's coming out. I don't know, to be quite honest. I plan on touring with this for the next 3 to 4 months and working on a second project and continuing to speak. And hopefully I can continue to do that, stay on the road with speaking and with writing more. But we'll see. But yeah, it's very exciting for me. And I don't really know exactly what I want out of life yet. Honestly, this was the only real big thing I think I've ever really wanted, you know, like that. I'm okay with that.
I know that when we place this call, you're visiting your mom.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, I'm down visiting my mother.
I'm kind of curious, when you first decided to embark on this thing, you know what moms are like. When you first decided to embark on this thing, you're taking a motorcycle, you know, which is basically to what most moms think.
Yeah,
motorcycles are death traps on wheels.
People ask, how do you get your parents to be okay with that, or do you have a weird relationship with them or whatnot? And the answers are, or how do you do something like that and still get a good relationship with the parents? The answer is you just don't tell them. You know, you just have to make your own decisions in life. And our relationship, I felt like it had been somewhat naturally that way for years. So it didn't feel like a huge thing, though. I guess in retrospect, it kind of was.
So if you don't tell them,
worried.
so if you just don't tell them, how surprised are your parents by what's in the book?
I think they learned not to be surprised by me, unfortunately, years ago. Probably the biggest surprise they had was a couple of years ago, in fact, in the middle of this journey, if you can call it that, because in a lot of ways it's just the same life I'm living now, with a little more structure now. But in the middle of it, I eloped. I got married, and I brought home a bride that my family, my sisters, and my mother had never met before, my grandparents. And so if they could go through that and be okay with it and still be friends of mine and let me hang out with their children and trust me, then I guess I must be an okay guy in some regard, right?
Okay, so we have less than a minute. You
sure.
You just eloped, so I have to ask this question. Down the road, you have children, and they say to you, "Dad, I want to take the same trip you did."
Well, luckily for me, I was able to get out of that relationship before any kids, because, you know, I wanted to be able to keep going with this, you know, and I wanted to see it through, and that was years ago, and she wanted to have kids for that. You know, honestly, if I do have kids one day and they want to, I hope that they follow their heart, they chase their dreams like this, even if it means doing something crazy, and, you know, like I did in that situation. If they get in a situation like that where they feel like they need to decide between their dreams and somebody else's dreams for their life, as long as they're not hurting somebody else in any irreparable way, I hope that they choose their dreams and their hope for the future, their dreams for others.
The book is called Land of the Free by Woodrow Landfair. Woodrow, thank you very much for being on the program with us, and continued success in all you do.
Hey, Peter, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Woodrow Lanfair, author of Land of the Free. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0249, and you'll find links to Woodrow's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on The Stuff File program, we'll talk about the porn industry. Plus, Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. Plus, lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a French father decided to put a new twist on some old classics in order to get rid of a group of people he suspected were selling drugs outside his apartment building in Montrouge. French dad Joël turned to nightly doses of classical music from artists like Mozart and Beethoven to get rid of the men who were routinely smoking, drinking, and allegedly dealing drugs near his home. It started out with Joël singing himself. I don't know what came over me. I opened the window and I started singing and shouting songs like Little Green Mouse or My Little Rabbit, he said. It was a peaceful solution to take back our property. Realizing that his repertoire was somewhat limited, Joel began using recordings to keep the dealers away. They asked me why I was doing it, Joel said. I told them their noise bothered me. In addition to Mozart and Beethoven, Joel has turned to pieces like The Nutcracker by Tchaikovsky. Now, some of the dealers have fought back by playing rap music, but Joel has vowed that the classical program will go on. I filed a complaint with the police, but I'm not going to stop, he said. Their behavior is unacceptable. Music soothes the savage breast. Drug dealers, not so much. Anyway, we have a couple of marketing challenges that a few products might have to follow through if they make it. Number one, in January, the London Daily Telegraph found three British companies in competition to sell deodorant supposedly made especially for women's breasts. Now, according to one, Fresh Body it's called, we're replacing swoobs, that's the dreaded boob sweat, with smiles. Oh, wow. Can't wait to see the television commercials for those. And number two, owner Christian Ingber recently opened a sandwich shop in Gothenburg, Sweden, named A Bleeping Awesome Sandwich. And you can pretty much guess what the bleep is. Yes, it's the F word. Anyway, an American expatriate told Sweden's The Local News Service that Swedes think English curse words are cute and charming. Yeah, they never met my mother. Anyway, I want to see food items from that store show up on someone's corporate expense account. That ought to be interesting for the folks at HR. And moving right along, here are some medical marvels to share. We got a couple of them to put together in this program for this edition of the Stuff File program. China's Chengdu Commercial Daily reported in March that 23-year-old Yu Yonggang finally had surgery to remove that whistle that he swallowed when he was 9. He has been experiencing worsening breathing ever since he was 9 years old and had been making shrill whistle sounds nightly after falling asleep. And number two, London's Daily Star featured Sarah Beale, age 43, of Arley, Warwickshire, England, in a March story demonstrating her skin condition, in which writing words on her skin makes it puff up for about an hour before it recedes. It is referred to by doctors as the Etch-a-Sketch condition, formerly dermatographia, and despite occasional pain, she described it as cool and a party trick. Yes. Well, wait until she discovers the marketing and advertising opportunities that can be had in the future. And by the way, does it really go away after an hour by itself, or like an Etch-a-Sketch, do you have to shake her? A police officer in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, stopped a man to inquire why he was riding down the street on a bicycle with a dining room chair strapped to his back. While they were talking, a car smashed into the back of the officer's patrol car and sped away. The car stopped at a filling station and the passengers got out and ran, but backup officers caught up to them. It was not reported why the cyclist had the chair strapped to his back. Well, you know, sometimes it's just good to sit down and watch things unfold. Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. By the time police arrived to investigate a burglary at Florida E-Cigarettes and Vapes in Boca Raton, the owner had identified the suspect. When he found the break-in, the store owner looked at his security camera videos and recognized the intruder as a regular customer. The customer is so satisfied with the store, he promotes it on his social media pages. The shopkeeper showed officers the man's Instagram page, which not only has photos of the suspect matching the intruder, but also showed his full driver's license. That made it pretty easy for officers to arrest Tanner Bradshaw, age 18, who was allegedly found carrying products stolen from the store and charged him with burglary. Talk about the agony and the ecstasy, huh? I mean, finding out that your best customer, or at least one of your best customers, will now be going away for a while because he robbed you. Yeah, the yin and yang of life. There you go. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? What is it actually like in the world of the porn industry? That's what filmmaker David Mech shares with his documentary, Risky Business, A Look Inside America's Adult Film Industry. David joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communication from Florida. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
How did you come about to do this as a topic for a documentary?
Well, you know, I worked with the adult film industry for over a decade, and I know the ins and outs. And every time I would see media about the adult film business, they usually portrayed it. They either took an extreme example of something that was on the periphery of what was happening and made that out to be how the business is, or even pro-porn documentaries made it seem much more kind of peachy, as you would say, than it is. So this is really kind of a realistic assessment of what it's like for performers that decide to come into the adult film industry. Most of the documentaries out there on porn are more about the business of porn. So there's plenty of that out there, but there wasn't a lot about the performers. You know, where do they come from? How do they get into the business? What are their experiences in the business? And then after they get out of the business, you know, how do they handle careers, relationships, the social stigma that comes along with it? So we talk about a lot of, like, you know, potential regulation that could come, both in the health and safety side, as well as in the employment discrimination that a lot of people face when they get out of the business. I don't know, recently in the news, in the last couple weeks, you know, there was a story about Chase Bank, which was closing a lot of the accounts, bank accounts, of people who were adult film performers. So other than just the fact that they chose to be performers, that's the only reason their accounts are being closed. That's one of the examples of the discrimination these people face.
Well, what is the biggest misconception about the adult film industry?
You know, there's a lot. I think one of the primary ones is they think that people who come into the adult film industry are somehow, you know, bad people, or you know, there's all this discrimination. If they find out a teacher did porn or a cop did porn, all of a sudden it's the end of the world, and that person should be fired, even though there's absolutely no data to support that. When you look at, for example, you know, you need to be 18 years old to perform or to consume pornography. But we as a society, at least in the United States, I know you Canadians are more progressive, but here in the United States, you have to be, you know, 21 to consume alcohol. So at least in our society in the United States, we're saying, we're kind of signaling that there's more of a damage associated with alcohol than there is with the consumption of adult media. Now, if you have a teacher, for example, who happens to own a bar or who happens to just go out drinking with her friends, his or her friends, that's not a problem. That isn't a bad role model. That isn't a bad teacher, whereas if that same teacher were to have made an adult movie or to have danced in a strip club to put herself through college, all of a sudden it's the end of the world. Now, why is that? I mean, the threshold for alcohol is higher, so clearly the person who is consuming alcohol should face more of a scrutiny. I mean, and not to mention, you know, people who, if there's a teacher who gets a DUI, that teacher usually doesn't lose his job. But think about the role model elements of that. I mean, your students are reading in the news that, you know, professor, you know, teacher, science teacher Joe Schmo just got a DUI. And in the process of getting a DUI, think about all the lives that you put at risk. I mean, people who are, there's plenty of data that shows people who are intoxicated behind the wheel leads to tremendous loss of life all throughout the world, and innocent people die. Yet when you make pornography, nobody has ever died from an overdose of pornography. It's a product that's produced by and for consenting adults. And this sort of social stigma that comes with it is just unfounded. So I think that's the big misconception, is you find out that somebody you know is somehow affiliated with the business, and people assume that person to be bad or to be of like an immoral character. There's absolutely no data to support that.
Okay, so your film Risky Business, A Look Inside America's Adult Film Industry, shows a side of the business that people never see. So let's talk about some of the things. For instance, what are the working conditions like?
Well, I mean, the thing is, people can make a lot of money working as performers, particularly women. They make about twice as much as the guys do. But, you know, one of the sort of dirty little secrets about the porn industry is that, you know, the testing that they do really isn't adequate. I mean, they think it is. They say, you know, the idea is, you know, you come in, you test once a month. I think they might have recently pushed up to 2 weeks now. But even if it's 2 weeks, I mean, you come in, you do a test, you're negative for gonorrhea, chlamydia, HIV, et cetera, and you do your shoot. And then let's just say the next day you decide to go have sex with somebody as an escort, or just some random person you meet at a bar. And let's just say conceptually that you contract HIV from that person because you had, you know, unprotected anal sex. And the next day, now you go and you shoot a scene in the porn industry and you say, hey, look, my test is clear. Well, yeah, your test was clear as of 2 weeks ago, but you just had sex with this person the other day. Now you have HIV. Nobody knows it because you haven't retested yet. And what a lot of people don't know is when you get an HIV infection, you are most infectious at the time you get the initial infection, and because your body hasn't built up all the antibodies to it and all this kind of stuff. So when somebody first acquires HIV, they are most risk of redistributing or reinfecting other people who they have sex with in that shorter amount of time. So it's using condoms is a very low cost, easy way to mitigate a huge risk, not just with HIV, but also with chlamydia, gonorrhea, etc. You have these organizations, these public health organizations like the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, that are really driving this process forward in California, where now they have condom mandates, at least at the county level in Los Angeles County, as well as the city. They're trying to get a statewide mandate. And a lot of the producers are now leaving and coming to Florida and to Nevada. But AIDS Healthcare Foundation has vowed to sort of go after them. And they should. I mean, there's no reason that somebody who's completely, you know, if I'm a girl and I'm always using condoms in my personal life, and I decide that, hey, listen, I'm 18, I don't have a lot of education, and maybe I have a kid and I want to go to college and I need to make $1,000 in a day because I can't make that working at Starbucks, and I don't have a law degree to make that in a professional capacity, you know, the adult industry is an option. So if here's a girl who's practiced safe sex her whole life, and then she goes to a shoot, she has to work without a condom, contracts a disease as a result of having gone to work, essentially, that could have easily been mitigated by just using a condom. You know, I think that's ample evidence or enough rationale to show that condom use should be required in porn, and that there isn't, you know, a problem with that. And when you look at You have these companies like Wicked Pictures that have been around forever, and they're a condom-only company. And a lot of producers make the argument, well, you know, if you shoot with condoms, it's not going to sell. Nobody's going to buy the product. Well, Wicked Pictures doesn't have low-budget films. They have high-budget films, so they have to sell more movies to offset that production cost. And they're able to do that using condoms. Initially, Bang Bros and Reality Kings are some of the biggest adult internet companies here in Miami, and they, at the time, were condom-only, and they were the leading company. They're no longer condom-only because everybody else isn't shooting condoms, so they figured, well, you know, why should they? But at the time, it didn't prevent them from selling memberships and you know, getting a lot of people to sign up for their sites.
So when you created this movie, Risky Business, A Look Inside America's Adult Film Industry, who were you seeing as your primary audience?
My primary audience for that documentary are what I would call, you know, curious intellectuals, people who said, hey, I wonder what this industry is about. And it's really more of an academic documentary. I mean, if you're looking for titillation and naked people and sex acts, I mean, you're not going to find that in this documentary. This is basically a documentary that would be shown to like a public health course, maybe a women's studies class, that would really want to understand how the inner workings of the adult industry happen. And I think if more people, you know, particularly politicians and attorneys and people, you know, people of social influence watch this documentary, they wouldn't be as quick to sort of fire teachers or fire cops, really because, you know, once upon a time they happen to make a couple movies and they somehow think that that impacts their ability to do their jobs effectively.
You talked earlier about, you know, the use of condoms versus the use of the non-use of condoms and the testing and all of that. It sounds like, I mean, you said no one's ever died from making porn movies as opposed to, as you say, you know, having a DUI. But it sounds like you're playing sexual Russian roulette in this industry.
Well, to the earlier quote that I made, I was talking about consumption. Nobody's ever died from consuming adult materials, but they haven't died from consuming, you know, but they have died from consuming alcohol or the sort of subsequent actions that come from consuming alcohol, not to mention domestic violence, etc. You're playing Russian roulette, but to a certain degree. You have to understand what your risk group is. When you look at HIV distribution, it's overwhelmingly in what they call MSM populations, men who have sex with men, as well as intravenous drug user populations. There's also an uptick in African-American populations, but not nearly as strong of a lift effect and sort of a predictive model as would come with MSM or intravenous drug use. So if you really want to increase your risk of getting HIV, have rough anal sex with men that are doing intravenous drug users and that are African-American, that would be your sort of your highest risk of getting HIV. And your lowest risk of HIV would be, you know, aside from abstinence, I mean, assuming you're having sex, would be, you know, vaginal sex with non-drug using people, you know? So really in the porn industry, and part of the reason I kind of moved out of performing was because I was concerned about this sort of increased bisexuality where the gay performers are coming into the straight side of the business. And I don't have anything against gay. I love gay people. I think gay marriage, the whole deal, I'm all about equal rights. But, you know, data is data. And when you look at risk mitigation, for me as a straight male, I didn't want to be having unprotected sex with a lot of these girls who were having unprotected sex with sort of crossover performance from the gay side. And I sort of mitigated my risk by moving sort of out in front of the camera and more to behind the camera and doing more consulting work. But, you know, I think your bigger risk, aside from HIV, porn is really chlamydia, gonorrhea, these more common infections that are treatable with antibiotics, but or actually curable with antibiotics. But, you know, the idea is you shouldn't have to do that. I mean, you throw a condom on. A condom is very inexpensive, you know, particularly if you're buying in bulk. I think a lot of the opposition from the producers is less to do with sales and more to do with just getting the shoot done. It's hard enough for these guys to maintain an erection on set with people around, all the lighting, the technicality of the shooting these days. You know, it's just hard for them to maintain an erection as it is. So to add putting on a condom is only going to make it that much more difficult for the guys. But in a way, it's good for the strong performers because the ones that are able to do it will get more work and command a higher rate. And the people who aren't as good performers will be, you know, washed out into another job that maybe they're more suited for.
Okay, we have about less than a minute, so I have to ask this question because you touched on it briefly, the fact that you were a performer originally. So why did you get into porn in the first place?
I got into porn more as a political statement. I saw a lot of people like with the alcohol analogy or, you know, drugs, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There's all this data that shows that drug use is bad. All this data that shows that alcohol use is bad, domestic violence. There's no data that shows that sex is bad. If you're 30 years old and you've never had sex, most psychologists will say, there's something wrong with you. You should be having sex. Why haven't you had sex? Where if you're 30 years old and you say, I've never murdered somebody, that's normal. You're not supposed to you know, murder people. So this idea that sex is somehow bad or taboo or in this sort of subculture, I reject that notion. And by aligning myself with the business, me with a, you know, I have a post-grad education, no criminal background, barely drink, have never done a drug, I don't smoke. So it helps make that statement.
Okay. And how can one get their hands on the film Risky Business, A Look Inside America's Adult Film Industry?
They can go to the website, www.riskybusinessthemovie.com. Again, riskybusinessthemovie.com.
David, thank you very much for being on the program with us. It's been most enlightening.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
Filmmaker David Meck. His film is Risky Business, A Look Inside America's Adult Film Industry. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0249, and you'll find links to David's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A New York man has filed a lawsuit in a Manhattan court for $2 undecillion. That amount, which is a 2 with 36 zeros after it, is more money than exists in all the world. He claims his finger became infected after he was bitten by a dog, and he's suing the dog's owners, New York City, two hospitals, a department store, a bakery, and 1,000 other people. The lawsuit, contained in 22 handwritten pages, may be the most frivolous lawsuit ever filed. Not surprisingly, the man is representing himself, probably so he doesn't have to pay a huge contingency fee to a lawyer. Let's be fair, there are at least a gazillion reasons why this lawsuit should be thrown out of court. But that doesn't mean it won't cost someone. The man has filed at least 20 other lawsuits over the past 10 years, and somehow the courts keep letting him do this over and over again. Learn how frivolous lawsuits cost all of us. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And as we wind down the month of May, I'm just curious to know if Stuart Nauman is going to buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Well, I don't care if I ever come back.
How you doing, sir?
Pretty good. And make sure that those are the old, good old-fashioned Cracker Jacks with the real toys inside that you have to put together by yourself, the microscopic ones. None of that, just a fake little card. No. This has to be the real thing here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, we've alluded to baseball, and the reason for that is?
Well, in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a baseball team, in particular the Montreal Expos, because, you know, it's been 20 years since the 1994 edition of the Expos fielded one of the best teams in the franchise's history, only to have their Division League and World Series championship ambitions dashed by a player strike. And it's been 10 years since the Expos played their swan song season in Montreal before they pulled up stakes and headed due south to become the Washington Nationals.
A team, by the way, that's dead to me. So don't mention their name again in this segment. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's all right. The team that formerly known as the Expos. Okay. Now, the wounds of 1994 and 2004 haven't healed yet for many Expo fans. And on top of that, they keep asking themselves why Major League Baseball played such a cruel fate on the Expos. And what did the team do to deserve such a fate?
By the way, you are allowed to refer to them as the Beltway Bastards.
Well, Feel free. You just did. I could go back retro and say the Washington Senators.
But... No. They had two cracks at that can and they blew it twice. But then again, don't get me started. Go on.
All right, the Seattle Pilots, okay? They started the same year as the Expos.
Yes, I know.
And they ended the same year the Expos began. Well, you know what? I think those questions by those, you know, painful fans, and you're going to be adequately answered after you read Jonah Carey's book, Up, Up, and Away. Now, this is a book that has been a long time coming, and is a story that needed to be told about the Montreal Expos' 35-year roller coaster existence as a National League franchise. Yet when you start reading the book, the impression you get was that the Expos was a team that was bitten and cursed before they even took the field for their inaugural season in 1969, unlike the Seattle Pilots. For example, Mayor Jean Drapeau, told Major League Baseball that if Montreal was granted a franchise, the team would have a dome stadium of their own by 1972. However, before that became a reality, they had trouble finding the team a temporary home. The Laurier Downs, which was the home of the much-revered Montreal Royals, was too small and too old, and the Autostad near the Expo 67 site was too expensive to convert into a baseball stadium, which they settled on Jarry Park, which wasn't even a baseball stadium to begin with. It was a municipal park. Now, Carey outlines the many reasons why the Expos were such a beloved yet cursed team. One reason that really stands out was the team's inability to hold on to a good player for an extended period of time. Because of continuous financial difficulties and reluctance of a string of owners to let loose their purse strings and invest in trading and drafting talented players. It was almost like the team had no choice but to cut loose their best players for either money or players who were mostly mediocre at best. Gary Carter, Andre Dawson, Jeff Reardon, John Wetland, Marquise Grissom, Larry Walker, Vladimir Guerrero, the list of talented players the Expos lost to other teams where they excelled even further just goes on and on. Now, besides the terrific research and countless interviews that Carey conducted with former players, broadcasters, and front office personnel, he offers several sidebar pieces that give some new perspectives on different aspects of the Expos story, such as the brutally honest analysis of the team's 1969 opening day lineup, the story behind the MB logo, the appeal of Pascual Perez, the case of why Tim Raines should be a Hall of Famer, and why Vladimir Guerrero was the last Expos superstar. So whether you were a fan of Le Grand Orange or El Presidente, remember the painful legacy of Blue Monday, was harassed by Suki, the Expos pre-UP mascot, like I was, attended the 1982 All-Star Game, which I did, or was a proud resident of Jonesville, which I was also, Up, Up, and Away is a book that you must read so you can get the full story of the bittersweet history of the team that we affectionately called Nos Amor and realize how much we do really miss them.
You know, a friend of mine who has since passed away many, many years ago by the name of Larry Horowitz was a season ticket holder of the Expos from the day they came to town. And he was, I said Alan Horowitz. And Alan grew up in Brooklyn. And whenever I mentioned the Dodgers, he would look to me, he would look to the ground and he would spit. And I would always say, come on, get over it, you know. Now I know how he felt.
Yeah.
Now, because the LA Dodgers were dead to him, completely dead to him.
Well, it's almost like maybe we could, you know, regard Clobro Chu and Jeffrey Lurie as our Walter O'Malley.
Oh, no, because, you know, Walter did some decent things, and I don't want to, with the team when he moved them to Los Angeles, and I don't want to say anything else about the people who took the team away from here for fear of a libel suit. I'll just leave it at that. So the book is entitled
Up, Up, and Away by Jonah Carey. It's published by Random House Canada, and it's $32.
And what other books do you recommend in a similar vein, sir?
Well, there's some books that were written by former Expos memoirs. One, the unabashed No More Mr. Nice Guy by Dick Williams, who is a Hall of Famer and was the Expos manager during their heyday period of the late 70s, early 80s.
And by the way, I had the opportunity on several occasions to talk to Dick Williams.
Yeah.
That title is so apt.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just so when you read this book, when you read Up, Up, and Away also.
Yeah.
Late Gary Carter wrote a memoir called A Dream Season, which even focuses on his years with the Mets, does mention his years with the Expos as well. Warren Cromartie wrote a memoir called Slugging Out in Japan about not only his years with the Expos, but also how he revived his career playing for a Japanese baseball team. There's one of the first looks at the Expos, was published in 1983, called The Expos Inside Out by Dan Turner. And also, Danny Gallagher has written a couple of interesting sort of like love letter books to the Expos. His most recent book deals with the 1994 team. There's still, you know, enough reading about the Expos by former Expos or by Expo fans to appreciate, you know, a team that, you know, people did like a lot and, you know, wish had a better break than even the Seattle Pilots.
And again, the current book is, and by the way, let's not forget, let's toss Brody Snyder's hat into the ring there for a book of his as well.
Oh yes. The year the Expos almost won the pennant.
Yes.
Yes. Which great drawings by Aislinn too. Yeah. That was published in 1979. I know what you mean.
Great,
which
great
is,
book by
out of print, but Go find it if you can.
Absolutely. So again, this week's book is?
Up, Up, and Away by Jonah Carey. It's published by Random House Canada, and it's $32.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, Peter. And now I have to go back to the stands, but good old Jerry Park. Wait a minute. Didn't they turn into a tennis stadium?
Yeah, they did. They did. Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have a couple of Stuff File news stories to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. Japanese men who are looking for a place to drown their sorrows because of their hair loss now have a place where they can go. And on the cheap as well. Otosuki in Tokyo is now offering a balding discount to customers who are having follicle issues. And a sign outside the pub says that it supports, quote, hardworking fathers losing their hair due to job stress. Anyone who enters the restaurant, which features a Be Bald, Be Proud sign, can get a discount by showing their baldness to a server. The more bald customers that are in a group, the greater the discount the party receives. Said bar owner Yoshiko Toyota, baldness is a very delicate issue in Japan, but in Hollywood there are a number of stars who completely ignore their hairless state and proudly carry out their work. I thought it would be nice to foster that spirit here. If 6 bald customers ever come into the restaurant, they will receive a yet-to-be-determined top-secret surprise. I was thinking of some way to help support salarymen, but without a theme, the idea was lame, Toyota said. Then, one day, I was walking downtown and I kept seeing bald guys. That was it. Yeah. Okay. So they're going to offer discounts and a top secret surprise. I wonder if it's a hat. And finally, on the lam, parolee Mark Royal, age 51, spotted in his car by sheriff's deputies in Sacramento, California in March, led officers on a 35-mile chase before coming to a stop in front of the Placer County Jail in Auburn, and then surrendering. He told the puzzled deputies only that the food is better here than at the Sacramento lockup, but the deputies returned him to Sacramento anyway. Now, while there are many places I would drive more than 35 miles to eat at, jail isn't one of them, but I'm sure the folks at Placer County Jail must be appreciative. I mean, especially the cook. Who doesn't want their hard work singled out? Yeah. Anyway, we're at the end of the program here, which means we have just one more item to get to. And you know what that is, boys and girls? Yes, it's time for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
According to Don McCowan, 8 to 10 friends were hanging out in Honeyapath, South Carolina at 2:30 a.m. when they came up with an unusual recreational activity. Someone would wear a bulletproof vest and someone else would shoot him. 25-year-old Blake Wardell got the vest. 18-year-old Taylor Ann Kelly told authorities she got the gun. Now, if you haven't guessed what happened next, I should tell you that Don McCowan is the deputy county coroner. Anyway, the bullet went through the edge of the vest, above the Kevlar, and into Wardell's heart. Authorities say Kelly is not the shooter, but rather a liar who tried to take the blame for 25-year-old Timothy Fisher because he was already a felon. Kelly's charge was changed to accessory to a felony after the fact. Fisher has been charged with involuntary manslaughter. Now, you know this story could have gone one of two ways. It could easily have been a Darwin File story, but it's more complicated than that because several people are involved. I mean, why would you and a bunch of friends get together and just for the sheer fun of it, see how well a bulletproof vest works? Well, one reason and one reason only. Because you're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0249. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0249. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here on the air online online or as a download, we're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.